Chapter 19. Jason spent his first day of freedom in the apartment, marveling at its strange solidity. The scratch of the carpet against his bare feet, air that didn't taste like a rich stew of organics, walls that were vertical and a ceiling that was a flat plane above his head. Hollows on shelves, popular music that bounced its rhythms from hidden speakers. A kitchen full of wondrous, gleaming appliances. A refrigeration unit full of food designed for the human palate. Furniture. The Yuuzhan Vong didn't have furniture the same way that people did. It wasn't crafted or assembled. It was sprouted. And their sense of scale was different. The way they placed it in one of their rooms with its resinous floors and walls of coral or stabilized protein. Jason had said farewell to furniture, to hollows and kitchen equipment and refrigeration units and to everything else that was human. Finding it again was a rediscovery. Messages appeared on the comm unit. Way to go, Sprout. And, once again, Jason, you have answered a mother's prayers. The messages gave him a singing joy that stayed with him for the rest of the day. That evening his Aunt Mara tactfully hinted that he might buy some clothes, so the next morning he set off to do some shopping. He borrowed some of Uncle Luke's clothes and threw a cloak over everything, but people recognized him anyway. His face had been everywhere in the holocausts. Many were friendly, many curious, and only a few turned away with angry glares or muttered asides. The Jedi, it seemed, were more popular than they had been. He bought clothing from a Quarren tailor, who assured him that the drape was perfect and in the mode, at least for humans. Afterward he wandered the city, enjoying the elegant architecture beneath the vivid blue sky, and tried to ignore the fact that wherever he went he was the center of attention. Later, from the apartment, he tried to contact Verger, but was told she wasn't allowed calls. He spoke to Luke about it, but Luke only said, "You're on vacation, and that includes being on vacation from Verger." Then Luke invited Jason to sit by him. "I'd like to hear your ideas on the Yuuzhan Vong," he said. "Verger would be the one to ask," Jason said. "I have asked her. But I'd like to ask you. Their immunity to the Force aside, are the Yuuzhan Vong so very different from us?" Jason considered. "No. They have a tyrannical government, and their religion is absolute poison. But they're no better or worse than humans would be if we were raised in their system." Luke looked at him. "Do you hate them?" he asked. "No." Jason's answer was swift and very certain. "Why not?" This time Jason had to think. "Because," he said finally, "it would be like hating a child for being raised badly. It's not the child's fault. It's the parents. I could hate the leaders who made the Yuuzhan Vong what they are, but they're long dead, so why waste energy in hatred?" Luke rose and put a hand on Jason's shoulder. "Thank you, Jason," he said. "I understand them," Jason said. Luke seemed startled, his mind inward. "You do not hate because you understand," he murmured. "Sorry?" Luke's attention snapped back to Jason. "No, go on." "I was implanted with a slave seed, remember, and it interfaced with my nervous system. It was supposed to be a one-way communication link, to enslave me and give me my orders, but I discovered that it worked the other way. It's produced a kind of telepathy. I can extend my mind into the Yuuzhan Vong and into their creatures, and sometimes I can influence them." Luke looked at him in surprise. "You can touch the Yuuzhan Vong with the Force?" "No, it's different. I can't use the Force and my Vong sense at the same time." Luke's eyes narrowed in thought. "Can you teach this?" Jason had been wondering this himself. "I don't know," he said. "I don't think so. I think perhaps you need to be implanted with a slave seed, or some other form of Yuuzhan Vong control that can interface with your nervous system." A thought struck him. "I might be able to teach Tahiri. After what they put her through, it's possible that she..." might still be attuned enough to the Yuuzhan Vong to learn to do as I've done. Luke frowned. Tahiri found her experience at the hands of the Vong to be highly traumatic, and she's had some traumatic experiences since. I wouldn't want to force her to revisit an experience that damaged her. Nor would I. Jason didn't tell Luke about one of the consequences of what he'd just called his Vong sense. The fact that he was still in occasional mental contact with the entity whom the Yuuzhan Vong called the World Brain, the Duryam who controlled the environment of Coruscant. He and the Duryam were conspiring against the planet's world-shaping, sabotaging it in minor but annoying ways, through the creation of an itching plague, for instance. Jason had just inspired the World Brain to cause a sickness in the Maulur, the creatures who recycled Yuuzhan Vong waste, during what the Duryam sensed was an important occasion or ceremony. Though Jason could theoretically inspire the World Brain to more deadly action, from poisoning Yuuzhan Vong food to causing an ecological catastrophe, he had refrained. His empathy with the Yuuzhan Vong had grown along with his Vong sense. He would not be a mass murderer, not even of a deadly enemy. In part, that was why he hadn't told Luke of this particular ability. He didn't want his ability known for fear that someone would want him to use it as a weapon, though he realized that Luke would never ask such a thing of him. He felt that the more private he kept this secret, the better. The conversation with Luke was interrupted when a holojournalist commed, asking for an interview. Jason told the comm unit to refuse anyone it didn't already know was a friend. The following morning, Jason felt delicate, ate a bland breakfast, and returned to his bed. Luke left to do political things, and Mara went off to play counter-spy with her mouse droids. He was awakened by a call on the comm, which meant that the comm's artificial intelligence recognized the caller as family or a friend. He answered and stared into a pair of green eyes framed by curling blonde hair. Danny Quee. "Hello, Danny. Jason, I hope it's all right to call. I'm not sick or in quarantine or anything. I'm allowed to talk to people.
That's good.
Would you like to see a bit of the city? Or are you being besieged by friends?" "I'm not besieged by friends," Jason said. "I guess because they're as tactful as you are. But I'd just as soon not go anywhere public because I seem to attract crowds." She grinned, teeth white against her tanned face.
"I saw you on the holonews yesterday. Was that cloak supposed to be a disguise?"
"Not exactly."
"If you're not ready to face your public, then why don't I get a hovercraft and take you out to Mester Reef?"
"Sure." 20 minutes later, Jason met Danny at a public pier.
"Nice clothes," she remarked, and gave him a hug.
Soon they were on a craft racing west on its repulsor lifts, 10 meters above the water. Danny had provided diving equipment for two, as well as a light lunch.
"Fast work," Jason said. "I was going to go anyway. If I hadn't reached you, I would have gone with another friend."
He looked at her. "Anyone I know?"
"Thespar Trode. She's another unemployed astrophysicist."
"You're not employed these days?" Danny gave a wry grin.
"We'll talk about that later."
Mester Reef was in such tropical waters that no insulation suits were necessary, but Jason and Danny wore them anyway to minimize abrasions. The air supply was a light unit, worn on the back that silently extracted air from the water and fed it to the diver, and was limited only by its power supply, which was good for about 50 years. There was a vest that could be inflated or deflated to adjust for buoyancy, with pockets for weights to make sure the diver didn't pop back to the surface. Danny held a pair of swim fins.
"Old-fashioned transportation," she said. "I could have brought some drive units to speed us along under the water, but I think they're a distraction. It's better if it's just you and the reef and the ocean."
"Fine with me," Jason said. "It's not like we're in a hurry to go anywhere." The water was like a warm salt bath. Adjusting to the breathing apparatus felt natural, and was easier than using a pressure suit.
The inflatable vest was a little more difficult, and Jason found himself sinking or bobbing toward the surface until he managed to equalize his buoyancy properly. Once he adjusted to the experience, he found he could think himself higher or lower, and he didn't need the force for it either, just a kind of relaxation. A current ran along the reef here, and he and Danny simply drifted along. The water that leaked past the mouthpiece tasted of salt and iodine and 1,000 living things. Above was the rippled sunlight of the ocean surface. To one side, the vivid colors of the reef, on the other side, the boundless ocean, and below, the profound blue of the ocean deeps, clear and seeming to go down forever. They didn't dive below 20 meters or so, because below that depth the light faded away badly, and they wanted to see the brightness of the coral. The coral formations, the anemones, and the sponges were ablaze with brilliant color, and the fish and other animals were as incandescent as the coral through which they swam. There were hierarchies here. The coral rose like great ramparts of a castle, occasionally breaking toward the surface in towers. Living things attached themselves to the coral, or sheltered inside its convolutions, or imitated the coral with its colors, its seeming quiescence, and its stinging spines. Reef fish hunted these, searching among the coral for their dinners and sometimes being engulfed and digested by a cunningly camouflaged predator, while torpedo-shaped pelagic fish from the deep water ate the reef fish, darting in from the open ocean to strike, kill, and devour, coming from a place far beyond the comprehension of the reef fish, like pirates from another world. And everything on the reef was alive. The coral, the sponges, the fish, the crustaceans, and anemones, all were living things. Even the seemingly empty ocean was filled with microscopic life. That was the true wonder of it. Jason summoned his force sense and let the song of the reef enter him, all the tiny creatures living together in a complex, interconnected pattern, basking for a moment in the sheer glory of it. This was such a glorious change from the Yuuzhan Vong environment. There everything lived as well, but all was alien, strange, and full of sinister purpose. It was like living in a void. Here the reef and its life practically shouted at him through the force. Jason extended his force sense toward Danny. She was force-sensitive, but her training had been unsystematic, scattered into spare moments between battles and obsessive research. He sensed her startled surprise at the first touch of his mind, but she then relaxed, and he let the reef's existence flow into her, the great vital accumulation of all the tiny lives, and the two floated along the reef in silent communion, absorbed in the reef's complexity and abundance. Eventually they grew chilled, even through their insulation suits, so he and Danny rose to the surface, and Danny triggered the transponder that would bring her hovercraft flying toward them. It settled into the water 5 meters away and lowered its ladder so they could climb aboard. They took off their dive suits and let the sun warm them as they ate their lunch. And then, while digesting, they simply relaxed, stretched out side by side on the foredeck. "You said you weren't working," Jason asked. "No. I was working for the Jedi until my unit began to achieve results, and then we were co-opted by the government. And then, after we reached a certain stage, we were... well, we weren't disbanded, but some of my team was taken away. I'm taking some training in communications and infiltration so that I can help set up resistance cells, and then I'll get back in the war." Jason rolled on his side to look at her. "But you've done such crucial work," he said. "You discovered how to jam the Yamask signal. That's the single critical discovery that's enabled our ships to survive battle with the Yuuzhan Vong. Why would they disband your group now?" She turned her green eyes to his. "Astrophysicists aren't important for war work," she said. "I made the initial discovery about how Yamasks communicate, yes. But now that the discovery's been made, it isn't a theoretical problem anymore. It's an engineering one. Now it's up to the engineers to build jammers and spoofers and try to work out more and more ingenious ways to foul up enemy communications. All the theoretical work has been quietly shunted aside. She sighed. I was working so hard and for so long. Nothing has ever been so thoroughly studied in such a short time as the Yuuzhan Vong. What Silgal and I did alone could have won us half a dozen major scientific prizes. But our work is secret, so the prize communities will never find out. And as far as anyone knows, I'm just a 23-year-old stargazer without a job and with no hope of finding one. She stretched languidly and looked at the brilliant sky. A strange look came onto her face, and she sat up, crossing her legs and leaning toward Jason. Not all the theoretical work has been pushed aside. Did I mention that? There's some still going on, and it's kind of strange. Jason blinked up at her. Tell me. We had some people in our group who were working on the details of Yuuzhan Vong Bioscience. They made a discovery, and right away were pulled away into a new unit in the Intelligence Division. They're working directly under a group of Chiss, who report directly to Diff Scour. Scour's working with Chiss? Jason was surprised. They're all off-planet now. None of my messages to my friends get through. I just get messages saying they're temporarily off the holonet. All at the proverbial secret laboratory off in deep space, Jason muttered. And why the Chiss? And you say you're working on Yuuzhan Vong Bioscience. Jason pondered for a moment, then shook his head. The problem is, we don't know enough about the Chiss to know why they'd be valuable. We don't even know where their home planet is. Maybe their bioscience is ahead of ours. Maybe they know something about the Yuuzhan Vong that we don't. Maybe their own weird metabolism gives them an insight into what the Yuuzhan Vong can do. Weird metabolism? They're blue. That's a clue right there. Danny laughed. Jason looked at her. Do you know the nature of the discovery the bioscientists made? She nodded. It had to do with Yuuzhan Vong genetics, which are generally like ours, by the way. Jason blinked. That's pretty odd, considering they're from another galaxy. There's one bit of their genetics that isn't like us, Danny said. There's a sequence that seems completely unique, and it's common to all Yuuzhan Vong life. You're a coral yamisks plant life, the Yuuzhan Vong themselves. All of it. Is that what makes us unable to see them in the Force? Danny shrugged. Maybe. The geneticists didn't know, or anyway they didn't when I last saw them. Silence fell. Jason gave a reluctant grin. We probably shouldn't even be talking like this, he said. Whatever Scour is doing with the Chiss, it's probably so deeply secret and off the map that our speculations are going to both be wrong and get us in trouble. Even speculating here? It wouldn't surprise me if I'm under some kind of casual observation, Jason said. I just came back from weeks of imprisonment at the hands of the Yuuzhan Vong. Intelligence can't be sure I haven't switched sides. He looked up at the sky and gave a wave. Say hi to the satellites. Danny laughed and waved at any invisible observers, then turned back to Jason. That's enough danger for today, she said. I think I feel safer underwater.
Me too.
Danny and Jason flew in their craft a few kilometers farther down the reef and put on their equipment again. As soon as they descended to the reef, Jason drew again on his Force awareness and let the life of the reef fill his spirit. He reached out again to Danny, and the two shared the swarming, intricate existence of the reef until it was time to return to Herkia. The next day, Jason went to the reef again with Danny, this time with her friend Thespar Trode, a female Ishitib, whose dive gear had been adapted to her giant head and eyes that thrust out on stalks. The two astrophysicists' conversation tended to be technical, but Jason didn't mind. He enjoyed the display of agile intelligence, even though he didn't understand it. And while he listened, he let his Force sense descend to the reef and fill his mind with living glory. After the dive, he invited Thespar and Danny to the apartment for snacks, but when he opened the door, he saw Jaina standing in the front room, still in her pilot's coveralls, her military duffel partly opened on the floor. He and Jaina stared at each other for a long moment of exquisitely painful joy. And then their twin bond flared with 1,000 shared emotions and memories, the rich harvest of lives shared since their first day in their mother's womb. And they rushed into an embrace. They pounded each other on the back and laughed until the tears came. Family was another thing that Jason had surrendered to the Yuuzhan Vong. The sensation of finding his twin again took his breath away. When he found it, he looked at the insignia on Jaina's coveralls. "You're a major now?"
"I'm better than that. I'm a Holovid star, not to mention a goddess."
Her eyes shifted to the two visitors standing near the door. She knew Danny Kui, of course, but had to be introduced to Danny's friend, Thespar.
"I have to change now and run," Jaina said. "I've got dispatches to deliver to headquarters."
She gave Jason a look. "And I've got a personal message from Admiral Creefe to Uncle Luke. He wants Jedi." Jason was pleasantly surprised. "At least someone wants us." She took a more formal uniform out of her duffel, disappeared into a bedroom to change, and then returned only to head for the door.
"We'll talk later, right?"
she said, as she paused on the threshold.
"I want to hear everything."
And then she was gone. Jason gazed at the closing door in surprise, as his mind tingled with the sensation of the fading twin bond. He had expected more from his first meeting with his sister, much more. She wasn't avoiding him, Jason thought. Not exactly. But she definitely needed some time to get her thoughts together before she could face him. He thought he knew why. Jason shared with his guests some jewel fruit he found in the refrigeration unit, and then the two astrophysicists said their goodbyes. Luke and Mara returned before Jaina did. When Jaina finally arrived, she was taut and high-strung, her neck and shoulder muscles rigid with tension. First, she delivered Creefe's request for more Jedi pilots to Luke, who was pleased to hear that someone in the military was willing to take Jedi. He asked about Jaina's action at Obroa Sky, and from there gently drew her into a discussion of her activities since the fall of Coruscant. Particularly, the battles at Hapes, and the way she'd used the Yuuzhan Vong's own Dovin Basils against them, to sow confusion and destroy the invaders. And her state of mind at the time, the obsession, the fury, the darkness. Jaina looked at Jason with bleak eyes and said,
"I thought you were dead. You and Anakin both. It didn't matter to me how many others were sent to join you. I was ready to go myself."
It was easier, Jason thought, for Jaina to speak to Luke and Mara than it would have been to speak to him alone. Luke had known that. "More than through anger or lust for power," Luke said. "The dark enters through despair. Through the belief that, in the end, there is nothing but pain and sorrow and death, and that nothing we do truly matters." He gave Jaina a look. "I'm here to tell you that we do matter, and that despair is an illusion that the dark casts before our eyes." Jaina lowered her eyes.
"Thank you, Uncle Luke," she said.
Jaina and her duffel moved in to share Jason's room. He wanted to talk to her before sleep, but she said she was exhausted from her long journey from Kashyyyk. She'd talk to him in the morning. Jason fell asleep at once and dreamed of the coral reef. He was awakened 2 hours before dawn, with the arrival of his parents. Half awake, he stood in the door while his father howled his happiness like a Wookiee, picked Jason off the floor, and whirled him around as if he were a 2-year-old. Leia's emotion was less demonstrative but no less powerful, and Jason felt it through the Force, even as his father twirled him through the air. When Jason found his feet again, he embraced his mother, and he sensed the force of Leia's profound thankfulness. It was she whose faith had never faltered, he knew. Her husband had deserted her and returned a changed man. The new republic she had created had betrayed itself. One of her 3 children had been killed, another torn away into captivity, and she had watched the 3rd slide toward the dark side. Leia alone held firm. Leia alone insisted that Jason was alive, And now Jason stood within the circle of his mother's arms and let her know that her faith had not been in vain. The hours that followed were exuberant and very emotional. Han was almost bouncing off the walls in his joy, at least when he wasn't trying to conceal a tear in his eye. C-3PO moved Han and Leia's belongings into their bedroom, and Jaina and Jason's gear out. The twins sacked out on the floor of the front room. C-3PO, with nowhere to go, propped himself against a wall and shut himself down. No sooner had Jason closed his eyes than he heard a respectful tap at the door. Leia's Nogri bodyguards, who hadn't been taken to Bastion, were now reporting for duty. They were placed outside in the corridor, and an hour later knocked again, this time because Verger had been released from detention and had nowhere else to go. Jason was delighted to see her, but clearly the apartment was too crowded, even after Jaina volunteered to shift to bachelor officers' quarters. But fortunately, Jason had a mother who was a princess and had connections. The Solo family, with C-3PO, moved to another apartment along with the Nogri. Jason hoped Verger might come along, but Luke rather firmly stated that she would remain as his guest. It was probably a good idea, Jason reflected later. When his parents found out what Verger had actually done to him when he was a prisoner, they wouldn't have looked at the little alien kindly. Jason would hate to have to get between Verger and Han's blaster. The move took much of the day, and as soon as it was over, Jaina had to report to Fleet Command to see if any decision had been made about Creefe's request for Jedi. She wasn't back until very late. The next morning, Jason rose, seated himself at the foot of his bed, and began to do his Jedi meditations and exercises. Calling the Force, using it to help modify his bodily state, slowing or speeding his heartbeat. Shifting blood flow to his muscles, as if for combat. To his internal organs, as if wounded or short on air. Or to his skin, to help radiate excess heat and cool the body. He sensed Jaina waking as the Force radiated from him, and likewise sensed her resentment. With a sigh, she climbed out of the bed, joined him on the floor, and merged her meditations with his. They synchronized breathing and heartbeat, lifted small objects, and then engaged in a mental lightsaber fight, sharing a mutual mental image of themselves in battle with one another, visualizing every move, every parry, the shuffle of their feet on the ground, the thrum of the lightsabers, the impact as the blades grated against each other. Jaina's fight was methodical and cool, utilizing minimal energy, content to back away until she saw an opening for an absolutely ruthless riposte. Jason permitted himself more freedom, making wild attacks and lunges, spinning in and out of range, striving to do the unexpected. As a result, he got nailed more often than not, and in the moment of his death, he sensed his sister's steely resolve. Afterward, as a calming exercise, Jason sent his Force sense radiating outward, sensing his sleeping parents in their bed, the two Nogri, one on guard, the other asleep, the sparks of life in the adjacent apartments. Seeking the wondrous dynamic complexity he'd found on the reef, Jason sent his Force sense floating even farther, down into the deep surrounding Herkia floating city, sensing the masses of microscopic life, the swarms of fish that had adopted the city as their home. The deep-water pelagic fish that darted into the city's shadow to prey on the smaller fish. Jaina pulled away. Jason opened his eyes in surprise and saw her getting to her feet. "Sorry," she said. "I can't go there right now." He blinked at her. "Why not?" She reached into the closet and took out her uniform. "I've got to stay focused on my job. I can't let my mind go floating around in the ocean. I've got to stick with what I can use." "It's life, Jaina," Jason said. "The Force is life." Jaina looked down at him. Anger smoldered in her eyes. "Life isn't what I do anymore," she said. "What I do is death. I kill and I try not to get killed myself. Anything else," she waved her hand, "is a luxury." "Jaina," Jason began, "every second I spend floating around the ocean," Jaina said, "I'm getting weaker and the Vong are getting stronger.
So what I'm going to do—she opened the door—is take a shower, get into my uniform, and go to headquarters to see if Admiral Sov has a message for me. And if he doesn't, I'm going to find some pilots and talk tactics, so that maybe I can learn a trick or two that will keep my squadron alive through another fight. I'll see you later. Maybe.
It's all about balance, Jaina, Jason said. But she was gone, and the refresher door shut behind her. Jason rose and sadly began to change into his clothes. Later, after breakfast, he told his mother what Jaina had said. Leia sighed.
Jaina and I already had this argument at Hapes, she said. I begged her to get some leave, get away, get some perspective. But she wouldn't, and I know how far I'd get if I repeated my arguments now.
Uncle Luke said that despair was access for the dark, Jason said.
Leia shook her head. Jaina's learned about the dark now, she said. She's been there, and I can't believe she'd go again. What I fear now is that she'll set herself one impossible task after another until she breaks.
Jason looked at his mother. No one in the family's like that, I'm sure.
She laughed. Of all the things Jaina could have inherited from me, she had to pick my work ethic.
She reached out and took Jason's hand.
Jaina's tough, you know. She'll get through this, and it will help that she has one less brother to mourn.
Jason tried to smile. At least I've given her that, he said.
4 days into his term of office, Cal Omis summoned Admiral Akbar and Winter to the former resort hotel that now housed the executive branch of government. The meeting was small. The only other guests were Luke, Idar Neely Kirka of Fleet Intelligence, New Republic Intelligence Chief Diff Scour, and Supreme Commander Sin Sov. YVH droids patrolled the corridor outside. Scour's people had thoroughly swept the room for listening devices, and so had Neely Kirka's, who sneaked in later without Scour's knowledge. The room was small, with no viewports. A small white marble table, scalloped like a seashell, held indentations for each of the guests. On one wall, a little fountain tinkled and chimed, emitting a mild scent of brine. Akbar wore his old uniform. His skin was gray and his hands trembled, and Winter had to help him to his feet as Cal entered the room. But his voice was firm as he congratulated Cal on his appointment, with none of the slurring that Luke had heard before.
"I would like to thank you all for agreeing to meet with me," Akbar said. "I know that you're all very busy trying to put the new government together."
"We're never too busy to meet with one of the greatest heroes of the rebellion," Cal Omis said. "You were my commander for many years, so please don't think I'm going to start pulling rank on you now."
"It was Borsk Felia who insisted on your retirement," Sin Sov said. "Please understand that no one in the Defense Force wished you to go, and least of all myself."
"That's very kind," Akbar said.
His trembling hands keyed a data pad on the table before him.
"Though the retirement was welcome in one sense, I now possess a great deal of time to think, and I have been thinking a great deal about the Yuuzhan Vong, the greatest menace to the security of the galaxy since Palpatine."
He splayed his huge hands on the marble table.
"My speculations aren't completely uninformed, because I have friends within the government who have provided data."
He looked up at the others.
"Nothing secret has come my way, but some analyses have found their way to me."
Luke glanced into the polished tabletop and viewed the reflections of Neely Kirka and Diff Scour, both of whom were being careful to maintain innocent expressions. Admiral Sov's jowled face was likewise bland.
"And of course, I've been in the service a great many years, all at the highest level," Akbar continued, "and I understand how the service works. Even the service under Borsk Felia."
He nodded his huge head.
"So let's open the survey with our military."
"We are growing stronger," he began. "When the war started, contracts were awarded in order to increase in our force strength. More capital ships, more fighters, more transports, larger ground forces. The shipyards at Kuat, Talan,
Corellia, and here at Mon Calamari, have been disrupted by the war but not fatally injured. And now they are delivering new capital ships, while many contractors dispersed throughout friendly space are delivering large numbers of smaller craft. It took a while, Luke knew. First you built droids, and then the droids built a factory. Not for warships, but for more droids. Then the first set of droids, plus the new droids built by the factory, built another factory, and that built ships, while the first factory continued to build new droids to build new factories, to build new droids to build new factories to build ships. You could keep going forever building new factories, new droids, and new ships, provided supplies weren't interrupted and someone was willing to pay for it all. Once the cascade started, it just kept growing, and the only way to stop it was to destroy all the factories, ships, and droids, because if just one droid survived, that droid could start the cascade all over again by building another droid. What this meant was that new ships were coming into service, and they'd keep coming, in geometrically increasing numbers as the largely droid workforce brought new factories online. "We also have many new recruits," Akbar went on. "Despite the efforts of the Peace Brigade and others favoring surrender to the Yuuzhan Vong, many idealistic citizens have volunteered for the military. Many of these have been drawn from refugee populations who prefer the hazards of battle to the tedium of refugee camps. And the refugees, who have seen their homeworlds destroyed or occupied, provide a highly motivated brand of recruit, who wish to win back their homes and take vengeance on the enemy. The bottleneck in making use of their volunteers hasn't so much been their numbers, but the necessity of building training camps in safe areas and staffing them with qualified instructors. But this has now been done." Luke knew that building training camps and training recruits ran along the same lines as building ships and droids, except that military instructors couldn't be built as easily as droids or turned out in a factory. Still, in addition to the instructors the military possessed at the beginning of the war, there were a great many veterans of the rebellion who had returned to the colors and were busy training the next generation in every tactic they knew. "The drawback to so many new ships and personnel is that they are untried," Akbar continued. "Successful actions against the Yuuzhan Vong have been few, so there is no standard fleet doctrine based on consistent success in battle. Now that New Republic research groups have succeeded in at least temporarily canceling the advantages given the Yuuzhan Vong by their—" He glanced at the datapad. "Their Yamasks." His pink-whiskered lips working delicately at the alien word. "We may take greater risks with our new forces, but still we will be putting raw recruits up against seasoned enemy veterans, and in the normal course of events, may expect to take heavy casualties. Our problems have been compounded by failures in intelligence," Akbar continued. The two intelligence directors, Luke saw, received this judgment without surprise. "We were invaded by an unknown enemy of unknown force, of a species unknown to us, and impelled by unknown motives. We could not infiltrate them. We could not scout their homeworlds. We could not even speak their language. Even the famous and highly regarded Bothan secret services were unable to accomplish nothing. Small wonder that we could not predict their actions. That lack has, to a degree, been remedied, with better knowledge of the enemy and with agents now in place on enemy worlds. So much for our capabilities." Akbar paused, and one large hand loosened his collar. "I should like to continue with an analysis of the enemy." He paused, perhaps waiting for a question, then went on. "The Yuuzhan Vong invasion of our galaxy has a religious justification," he said. "Perhaps the leadership cynically uses religion to camouflage other, less noble reasons for the assault, but there is no doubt that most Yuuzhan Vong sincerely believe that their gods have given our worlds to them. Because they have no doubts on this score, they form a highly motivated, dedicated, tenacious, and ideologically unified core of invaders.
While the experience of Jason and Anakin Solo suggests that the Yuuzhan Vong have divisions among themselves and disagreements among their leadership, they nevertheless present a united front to all outsiders. Our attempts to divide or corrupt them have been fruitless. As far as I know, and my knowledge on this score is necessarily incomplete, we have been unable to turn a single Yuuzhan Vong into an informer or spy. While it is possible that Yuuzhan Vong religious faith and ideology may weaken as a result of contact with us, with occasional defeats and with a galaxy more complex than their ideas can sustain, we can't count on being able to divide one group of Yuuzhan Vong from another as a means to our victory.
While Akbar spoke, Winter quietly rose from her place, walked to the tinkling fountain set in the wall, and soaked a handkerchief in seawater. She returned to Akbar and efficiently swept moisture onto Akbar's graying skin. Diff Scour gave a ferocious sneeze. Akbar paused for a moment, then continued.
The enemy's greatest successes have been in the realm of intelligence. The galaxy was thoroughly scouted before the first attack. Spies and informers were placed or recruited throughout all target areas. Our government was penetrated at its highest levels. Agents such as Nomanor had stirred civil conflict that distracted us from the real threat of invasion. Enemy agents, puppets, and collaborators were able to keep us thoroughly off balance throughout the critical early months of the assault. Even now we have no certain knowledge that our most closely guarded secrets are not in the possession of the enemy. The knowledge that the Yuuzhan Vong may be fully aware of our movements has paralyzed our leadership and tended to make them overly cautious.
Luke glanced at Sin Sov. His heavy-jowled face was expressionless, but Luke sensed no resentment of this analysis in the Sullustan.
"Material losses are irrelevant to the Yuuzhan Vong," Akbar continued. "Apparently their ships are grown and harvested like interstellar fruit. They can have as many warships as they can find Vong and Vong collaborators to crew them." "And as for crews," Akbar said, "I have on my data pad some estimates of initial Yuuzhan Vong strength and their casualties thus far in the war. These are approximations, since we really don't know the strength of any extragalactic reserves, nor do we have anything but estimates of Yuuzhan Vong casualties, and these may be exaggerated."
He cleared his throat. "They often are. You may view these figures, if you like, on your own data pads. I am prepared to send them to you."
Luke took out his data pad and set it to receive. Figures shimmered across its screens. Estimated total population, percentage of population estimated to consist of the warrior caste, an estimate of the number of casualties inflicted by New Republic forces, almost all members of the warrior caste. Casualties reflected as percentage of total warrior caste.
Luke looked at Akbar in astonishment.
"We've killed almost a third of their warriors?" he asked. "So these figures imply," Akbar said.
"They're very approximate," Cal Omus pointed out.
"They're the best we have," Akbar said. "I don't think they're far wrong."
"Our figures at New Republic Intelligence imply much the same thing," Diff Scour said. Luke was always surprised that someone as pale and thin as Scour had such a strong voice. "The Vong lost an entire battle group at Obroa Sky," Needy Kirka put in. "They failed at Hapes, and Yuuzhan Vong casualties at Fondor and Coruscant were heavy, even though both were victories for the Vong."
"They cannot afford any more such victories," Scour said.
"If these figures are correct," Cal said, "I don't want to throw our fleets at the enemy on the basis of guesswork."
"There are ways of testing whether the figures are correct," Akbar said. "If the Yuuzhan Vong stage another large offensive against a major target in the next 2 months, we'll know that they have warriors to spare. If instead they consolidate their gains, we'll know that their losses have taught them caution."
Idar Nili Kirka and Sin Sov looked at each other uneasily. The thought of a massive attack on Corellia, Mon Calamari, or other important targets was never far from their thoughts.
"The Yuuzhan'vong warriors are brave," Akbar went on. "They are aggressive. They obey orders without hesitation, fight to the death, retreat reluctantly or never, and never surrender."
He drew a long breath and sighed it out. "Considering their other advantages, it is lucky for us that they possess these weaknesses."
Luke stared at Akbar. Of course. Why hadn't he realized this before?
Weaknesses?
Scar's astonished cry filled the air. You call these weaknesses?
Of course,
Akbar said simply.
We can count on the enemy to have these traits. That means they are predictable. And while each of these traits may be admirable in itself, together they add up to massive and systematic weaknesses.
He held up one giant hand. Consider, he said, bravery and aggression result in foolhardy courage, and in any case are useful only with adequate direction. Unthinking obedience means a lack of flexibility. To fight to the death and never to surrender is to deny oneself useful alternatives. Together we can use these Yuuzhan'vong traits to draw the enemy into a trap from which he will never escape. Akbar extended a single finger as far as the hand's webbing would permit. Foolhardy courage will bring the Yuuzhan'vong into the trap. He held out a second finger. Unthinking obedience means that Vong subordinates won't dare to question their superiors, even if they have doubts. A third finger. Unthinking obedience also means that warriors can't exercise initiative and will continue to follow their superiors' plans even after a fluid combat situation has made them irrelevant. They won't change their plans without their superiors' permission, even if their superiors are out of touch or have an unrealistic idea of the situation. Akbar held up a fourth finger. Because the Yuuzhan'vong consider death inevitable and never seek to prolong their lives, they will continue to fight on, even in a hopeless cause. Their superiors' courage and belief in their cause will make them reluctant to order a retreat until it's too late. These facts together, my friends, form a weapon with which we will destroy the Vong.
He closed his hand into a fist and smashed it on the table. Cal almost jumped.
A trap, Luke said, implies bait.
Akbar gasped agreement as Winter moistened his forehead.
And the bait must be real. It must be something for which the Yuuzhan'vong will commit all their available strength.
And what is that? Cal asked.
Us, I suppose, Difskara said, looking about the table. The government.
His eyes in their hollow sockets turned to Akbar. What sort of timing are you considering? When should this trap be set?
At the moment we have a great advantage, Akbar said. We can defeat their Yamasks.
We can confuse their communications and cause them to fire at one another. We don't know if these advantages will last for long, so we should seek a decisive battle very soon.
But most of our forces are inexperienced, Sinsov said quickly. You have said this yourself. Dare we fight a decisive battle with so many raw troops?
No, Akbar said, we daren't. Our forces must be seasoned in battle before we attempt a major engagement.
How do we season them without a major engagement? Difskar asked.
Through many small engagements,
Akbar said.
The Yuuzhan'vong now have the same disadvantage that we had at the beginning. They have too many worlds to defend, too many trade lanes, too many resources. We should let the fleet loose on these targets, on all of them.
He held up a hand.
But we should never attack where we know the Yuuzhan'vong to be strong. Never engage where we do not possess an advantage. Our military must be seasoned, but seasoned only in victory. Through one success after another, they will learn to trust their commanders, and will grow in confidence to the point where they expect only victory.
His huge pop eyes turned toward Admiral Sov.
You must give your commanders a great deal of initiative in choosing their targets. You must give them permission to take risks, and occasionally to fail. Raid, skirmish, pounce on isolated detachments,
disrupt lines of communication, isolate enemy worlds from one another, establish hidden bases from which you can mount raids. But you must never engage the enemy where he is strong, only where he is weak.
The rebellion all over again, Calomus said. That's how we fought the Empire for the first years.
That's correct.
But when we fought the Empire, Cal continued, we didn't have so many places to defend. Our government was small and able to move to places like Yavin or Hoth. We didn't have millions of refugees to feed and resettle, or hundreds of senators demanding special protection for their worlds.
We must defend only those places that are vital to the war.
Akbar said, they must be defended, as we defended Coruscant and Borlias, to the point where even a victory would cost the enemy too much.
And what places are those? Cal asked.
Places where the new fleet elements are coming into being. Mon Calamari, Kuat, Corellia.
Akbar sighed again.
That's all.
That's all? Cal said.
Anything else?
Akbar waved a hand.
Give away when the enemy attacks. It will stretch Yuuzhan Vong resources and make them weaker everywhere else.
And the refugees? Luke asked. Those huge convoys that we've tried to protect? Those millions of people we've had to resettle? Akbar turned to Luke. His eyes were cold.
We must not defend these huge targets. Tying our forces to them only makes us weak.
Luke felt a chill settle into his spine. I've sworn to defend the weak, he said.
Who is weak? Akbar asked. We are weak. The government. The military. While we are weak, the enemy thrives, and the refugees are doomed no matter what we do. Once we are strong, the enemy will have more important things to do than to attack convoys.
Luke turned away. I understand, he said. But all his instincts warred against Akbar's bitter logic.
Difskar put his thin, knobby-jointed hands on the table. His skin was so pale that the hands seemed to fade into the white marble.
I ask again for your timetable, he said. You propose to put our untried forces into a kind of live-fire exercise against a real enemy in order to season them. How long before you think the fleet will be ready for a major action, or for this decisive battle your plan calls for?
Akbar's response was swift. 3 months, he said. 3 months of continuous, low-level engagement with the enemy should give us a battle-tested force able to hold their own against the Yuuzhan Vong.
3 months. A cold smile played about Scour's cadaverous face. The timing is expedient. The timing for what? Luke wondered. There was something highly significant about that 3 months. But Luke and Akbar were two, at least, who weren't meant to know what it was. Akbar slumped into his chair. Presenting the plan had exhausted him, and now he was finished, he permitted himself to show that exhaustion. Winter stroked more brine onto his head.
I only regret that my health doesn't permit me to serve the New Republic in a more active way,
Akbar said. Your contribution has always been fundamental, Cal said. I can only wish myself and these others as useful a retirement as yours has been. He turned to Sinsov. Admiral, do you have any comments on Admiral Akbar's plan? Other than to admire it? No, Sov said. I'm ready to put the plan into action immediately, or I can resign in favor of Admiral Akbar, and he can carry out his proposals without any interference from me.
Akbar waved a weary hand. No, my friend. I'm not in condition to command the defense force, and everyone here knows it.
Cal gave Akbar a thoughtful look.
Can you take a consultative role? He asked.
We can invent a title for you. Fleet Director of Strategy or some such.
The glabrous head nodded.
I'm willing to perform this task to the best of my powers.
His powers are very limited at present, Winter said. These were the first words she'd spoken since the meeting had begun, and they were in tones of quiet admonishment, like a governess bringing her charge under control. She looked at Cal Omis.
"It won't be possible for the Admiral to be kept on a schedule, running to meetings and inspecting fleet units."
Akbar waved a hand in protest, but Winter was firm.
"No, none of that. And no parades of visitors asking for advice or campaigning for promotion either."
She looked at Admiral Sov.
"Some reliable staff officers would be useful, to do the paperwork and take care of communications. But we can't have meetings like this all the time."
"We won't." Cal's voice was firm. "If I need to speak to the Admiral again, I'll call for an appointment and I'll visit him myself." He looked at Sov. "You'll make the other arrangements?" The Sullustan nodded.
"I will."
Cal turned to Luke.
"Is there any way that Jedi can aid this plan?"
Luke hesitated. "I'd like to suggest that we place the matter on the agenda of the first Jedi Council meeting."
"Very well."
Cal looked at the two intelligence directors, Scar in his civilian suit and Neely Kirka in his military uniform. "Any other comments?"
"I work for Admiral Sov," Neely Kirka said.
"At his direction, we can assist in formulating assessments of enemy strength and suggest possible targets." Diff Scar nodded his long head at Cal. "We can do much the same, of course, at the direction of the Chief of State." Luke detected the very slightest degree of condescension in Scar's tone, as if he were humoring the others in the room with a show of cooperation, and again he wondered what it was that Scar knew that he didn't. It was almost as though Scar thought that Akbar's plan was irrelevant somehow, but he was willing to pretend it mattered. He had been very careful to question Akbar concerning exactly when his plan for trapping and destroying the Yuuzhan Vong would become operational, and had been satisfied when he'd learned it would take 3 months. What was going to happen within 3 months that would change Akbar's plans? Did Scour have some other plan that would win the war? Or, a chill wafted up Luke's neck, did Scour know that the enemy would render Akbar's plan ineffective, perhaps by staging an unstoppable offensive within the 3 month period? Luke would have to watch Diff Scour very carefully, he thought. Perhaps, very quietly, Mara should watch him, too. 2 hours after the end of the meeting, the signal "Akbar is back" was broadcast to all New Republic military units. In some of the larger ships, the cheering went on for an hour.